first session features two sitting commissioners, one from the Federal Trade Commission and one from the Securities and Exchange Commission, who will be giving some remarks. So first up is Noah Phillips. Commissioner Phillips was confirmed by the Senate in April. Prior to the commission, he served as chief counsel to Senator John Cornyn on the Senate Judiciary Committee and in a variety of other roles advising the senator. Prior to his Senate service, Commissioner Phillips worked at Wasserstein Perella, an investment banker, and as a litigator at Cravath, Swain & Moore. So Commissioner Phillips, the floor is yours.
Thank you for the kind introduction and also the privacy warning. This is not our privacy hearing, but it's important that everyone think about that all the time. I'm really, really thrilled to be here to open today's excellent hearing and to welcome the distinguished group of scholars and market participants from whom we'll hear today. I'm also very thankful to NYU for hosting this event. I do think it is appropriate that we are here in New York to talk about this. I don't know whether Commissioner Jackson is here yet. I'm very pleased that he is joining us. He has spoken publicly about the need to bring competition economics to the Securities and Exchange Commission, and of course is joining us today. My only hope is that doesn't augur some sort of like interjurisdictional power grab on the part of the SEC. We're older, but we're scrappy, and we don't shy from a fight, so he should just know that. I want to start with the traditional FTC caveat, and that is the remarks that I give today are my own thoughts and don't necessarily represent the views of the commission as a whole or my fellow commissioners. Common ownership is an issue of particular interest to me. But it probably helps to just start with a little bit of a definition. Last year in front of the OECD, the US antitrust agencies defined common ownership as, quote, the simultaneous ownership of stock in competing companies by a single investor where none of the stock holdings is large enough to give the owner control of any of these companies, end quote. And I want to draw an important distinction. Common ownership is distinct from cross-ownership, wherein a company holds an interest in one of its competitors or other joint venture or co-partner scenarios that have long been a focus of US antitrust law. The most important thing for purposes of today about common ownership is that it is a reality of our modern economy and that it is ubiquitous. Americans are increasingly utilizing the many and diversified investment options that large institutional asset managers offer, and the advent of indexing funds has opened important avenues through which average Americans can invest their retirement savings, sometimes at a low or even zero price. They can also have pretty good returns. As a result of the growing demand for this popular product, trillions of dollars that these companies now manage are increasingly including shares of competing companies. That's a reality. In the last few years, economists and law professors have raised the question whether common ownership is negatively affecting competition. We have a number of them here today. I see Martin Schmaltz sitting over here. His work with Jose Azar and Isabel Tekeu kicked off such a bevy of research and commentary that it is often simply referred to as the airlines paper. I know that's not the only work, but it sort of set the ships to sea. Some are concerned that common ownership remedies proposed are quite dramatic. According to one group of scholars who are proponents of these remedies, addressing the threat of common ownership would upend, quote, the basic structure of the financial sector, end quote. For example, by limiting asset managers to holding no more than 1% of a given industry, unless they do so in a purely passive manner. And this debate is not just academic. Antitrust enforcers around the world are watching its development, as we are today, and incorporating common ownership into their analyses. For instance, last year, as I mentioned, the OECD held hearings on common ownership. And we've seen that European antitrust enforcers have begun citing these theories in their decisions. I find this debate particularly interesting because it takes us to the intersection of antitrust, corporate, and securities law and policy. And in a sense, historically, this is very fitting because in a way, the FTC grew out of the Bureau of Corporations at the Department of Commerce. When I spoke about this issue last in June, I noted an important way in which the intuition behind the antitrust theory of harm from common ownership runs counter to the longstanding concerns of those other bodies of law. Specifically, corporate law in particular preoccupies itself with the principal agent problem, the issue of how you get the management to work on behalf of the owners of the corporation, the shareholders. Management neglect of shareholders, and in particular of minority shareholders, is a particular concern. And the common ownership theory, or at least one version of it, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, is concerned that managers show too much attention to shareholders, and in particular to certain minority shareholders. In June, I identified several areas of research that I, as an antitrust enforcer, would like to see developed before shifting policy on common ownership. They were, first, how common ownership affects a broad group of industries. Second, whether a clear mechanism of harm can be identified. Third, a rationale why managers would put the interests of one set of shareholders, in particular a minority set, above the others. And finally, a rigorous weighing of the harms, of the allegedly anti-competitive harms against all the benefits of institutional shareholding. So the first question stems from the fact that common ownership is so ubiquitous. Is it also ubiquitously causing anti-competitive harm? And if so, how? Professor Manesh Patel, from whom we'll also hear today, writes about the sensitivity of the harm theories to various factors, including the structure of a given industry. We've seen some additional research since June. One recent working paper examines common ownership and competition in the ready-to-eat cereal industry, and another looks at pay-for-delay settlements in the pharmaceutical industry. I understand that economists are continuing to analyze the impact of common ownership in other industries. These studies are critical to understanding whether, and if so, how, common ownership might dampen competition between rivals. The better the research behind our enforcement, the better our enforcement will be. So the second thing I asked about was to identify a clear mechanism of harm. Identifying the mechanism of harm, that is, how common shareholding actually causes a lessening of competition, remains a matter of robust debate. Some proponents of predicating antitrust liability on common ownership acknowledge that, quote, the theory literature to date does not identify what mechanisms funds may use to soften competition, end quote. That's Fiona Scott Morton and Herbert Hovenkamp. Understanding the mechanism is, however, critical to developing a coherent legal theory of antitrust harm and ultimately to crafting an appropriate remedy. To my mind, there are, in fact, two competing theories of common ownership and how it might lead to anti-competitive harm. And for purposes of this discussion, I want to call them active and passive. The active theory involves managers affirmatively foregoing competition. Professor Einar L. Haig argues that the harm mechanism is less opaque than critics claim, noting that it would include all the ordinary mechanisms by which managers are incentivized to act in the interest of their shareholders: voting, executive compensation, the market for corporate control, the stock market, and the labor market. That's his quote. He cites examples of when common ownership might impact how the common owners encourage the commonly owned firms to behave. Professors Ed Rock and Daniel Rubenfeld, from whom we'll also hear, who disagree with Professor L. Haig about the remedies, offer a hypothetical of a portfolio manager who cautions airline companies not to expand capacity as they're coming out of an economic downturn. These types of active mechanisms may look like classic collusion, with which antitrust law is well familiar. And certainly where they involve active communication, the anti-competitive conduct and harm should be more easily observable. In the case of a portfolio manager on a call, literally public, they entail real-world affirmative action to which one can point, and as such, should be covered within existing antitrust jurisprudence. While presumably not intended to deal with competition, we have seen some asset managers themselves work together to effectuate what they view as social responsibility, as exemplified in recent reporting about principles for firearms dealers. The second theory of harm is what one might call the passive theory. Professor Schmaltz and others posit that because they own shares, I'm putting own in quotation marks, we'll talk about that later, because they own shares in competing firms that would all benefit from a lessening of competition, common owners do not have incentives to push their commonly owned firms to compete. Collusion of the sort contemplated in the active theory can exacerbate anti-competitive effects, but it is not required for this theory of harm to operate. This passive harm theory asserts that the common ownership harm derives from the absence of incentives from shareholders to encourage the firms in which they hold the shares to compete. In a sense, the anti-competitive harm asserted here is only a species of an incentive problem endemic to the economy, to the nature of the public corporation itself. As Burl and Means long ago recognized, and as I discussed in June, dispersing ownership among numerous shareholders reduces the ability and the incentive of any given shareholder to attempt to exert control, such as by pressuring a firm to compete more aggressively. This means not only common shareholders, but any dispersed shareholder may have reduced incentives to encourage the firm to compete. Professor L. Haig notes that the benefits from softened competition may also be shared more broadly among shareholders as a firm increases profits, for example, in an oligopolistic market. So while dispersed shareholders may lack an incentive to encourage competition in general, that may especially be the case if we can assume that they are affirmatively benefiting from oligopolistic pricing and profits. This passive theory raises a number of interesting issues in my mind. First, it appears to be in tension with some of the remedies proposed to address common ownership, which offer up, for instance, pure passivity, not my words, as a solution. If passivity itself is the problem, it can hardly be the solution as well. Second, at a time of concern about a lack of competition in the economy generally, is chilling shareholder input the right move? Should we not be considering mechanisms that would encourage companies to compete? The Hart-Scott-Rodino Act explicitly exempts from filing requirements acquisitions made, quote, solely for the purpose of investment, end quote, which the antitrust agencies have interpreted to mean as applying to purely passive shareholders. If we don't get enough encouragement to compete, is that the right approach? Years ago, Henry Manny explained that the market for corporate control helps to rectify the disparate power and incentives of firm managers and shareholders and affords, quote, to these shareholders both power and protection commensurate with their interest in corporate affairs, end quote. Actions that undermine the effective operation of the market for corporate control, including antitrust policy that fails to consider this market, may prove harmful to investors, but also to consumers. Third, how can we identify the marginal and purportedly negative effects of common ownership, where shareholders already have little incentive to encourage firms to compete more aggressively, and maybe even less than that, given the structure of a particular market, as I mentioned earlier, say an oligopolistic market? Consider liability under Section 7 of the Clayton Act, a theory propounded in the common ownership literature, where acquisitions are only unlawful if they are likely substantially to lessen competition. At what point do the effects of a share acquisition meet that substantiality threshold? Whichever theory you subscribe to or scares you, I look forward to today's discussion of the evidence. I'd be remiss not to mention two of our hosts, Professor Hempel and Professor Marcel Kahan, who conclude thusly with regard to the mechanisms of harm. This is a quote, and it's long, so forgive me. First, several mechanisms in the literature are not, in fact, empirically tested. Second, some mechanisms are ineffective in raising portfolio value or would pose major implementation problems for CCOs, common concentrated owners. Third, because most institutional CCOs have only weak incentives to increase portfolio value, they are likely not to benefit from pursuing mechanisms that carry significant reputational costs or legal liability, end quote. Third, my third question from June, was asking for a rationale regarding managers' responsiveness to certain shareholders, and apparently certain shareholders over others. This is another context where the assumptions underlying common ownership run up against assumptions underlying other legal regimes, specifically corporate and securities law. If the principal agent problem concerns you, and you think about shareholder neglect, or put a little differently, maybe, too little competition, understanding how shareholders and managers behave is critical to ensuring that we have coherent legal regimes that accurately capture harmful behavior and encourage beneficial behavior. Common ownership presumes that managers are very particularly attuned to the desires of a minority of their shareholders and act to maximize value to them. Whereas corporate law assumes that managers, unless forced to behave otherwise, will act to maximize their own interests over that of shareholders generally, and of minority shareholders specifically. So in a real sense, corporate law tends to worry very much that managers will not be responsive enough to their shareholders, while common ownership theories presume loyalty to select a few, often passive, investors. Professors Azar and El-Haig point to modeling demonstrating that if managers seek to maximize expected shares of votes or likelihood of being reelected, then they will seek to maximize the weighted average of their shareholders' profits from all their shareholdings. This model also demonstrates that shareholder variation in levels of common ownership will alter the precise weight managers put on each shareholder. But skeptics have raised questions as to the practical application and real-world predictability of such models. Are managers so acutely attuned to the shareholding levels and desires of their various shareholders? Do they respond in a precise fashion to those changing shareholder levels and desires? Do boards and senior managers of major companies even get involved in deciding issues like pricing? As noted earlier, common ownership theory proponents have responded in part that non-common shareholders might likewise benefit from softer competition, and so managers are not actually acting against the interest of most holders. But again, if all or most shareholders benefit from soft competition, such that none have incentives to actively encourage a firm to be more aggressive in competition, what additional impact does common ownership make? Much of this comes down to what shareholder and manager incentives actually are. There are reasons why shareholders might prefer softer competition in certain circumstances, but there are also reasons why they might not. For instance, if they are diversified across industries, as investors and customers to those setting oligopoly prices, they might not always benefit from oligopoly pricing in discrete industries. The answer can only be complex. Measuring those harms against the gains to those shareholders from softening competition. What's an asset manager to do? To the extent the answers are in fact nuanced, different shareholders with different perspectives, different preferences, different incentives changing over time, to the corporate manager, isn't competition the safest and most legal bet? Another issue. In my remarks thus far, I've been a little bit irresponsible about using words like own. Summer investment advisors or investment managers are beneficial owners, but are not the economic owners of the shares. Professors Hempel and Kahan criticize the empirical literature to date as paying insufficient attention to the systematic differences in the incentives of different investor types. They find that the empirical literature fails to take account of the possibility that investor types likely to be CCOs, those are the common concentrated owners, have systematically lower incentives to get involved than investor types likely to be non-concentrated owners. They explain that while the literature assumes the common owner's objective is to raise portfolio value, the archetypal CEO, the investment advisor, has incentives quite unlike those of an individual who holds the ownership stakes, end quote, and has only weak incentives to increase portfolio value. Consider an index fund where your goal is to sort of track the index, and lower fees. You're not necessarily looking for higher returns than that. How do these facts factor in? Finally, in June, I asked for a rigorous weighing of the pro-competitive effects of institutional shareholding. Several scholars debating common ownership have acknowledged that various proposals would alter, quote, the basic structure of the financial sector, end quote, and transform the landscape of institutional investing. Such tectonic policy shifts should not be undertaken lightly. Large institutional investors have, in many ways, made investing affordable for the average American. Index funds, for instance, as I said earlier, sometimes have nominal to no fees, and the returns are nothing at which to laugh. Such investing opportunities were unheard of before the second half of the 20th century. When considering policies that could find index funds as they exist today are fundamentally incompatible with the antitrust laws, we need to keep these very real benefits in mind. Many Americans simply do not have the funds available to buy into more expensive investment options. Scholars have also historically placed great hope in large, sophisticated institutional investors to have the incentives to make corporate governance better. Are they doing so? I look forward to hearing about stewardship practices today and how their development should be considered in this context. John Bogle, the inventor of the index fund, wrote last week about his concern that too few people control corporate governance in America. Are those concerns valid? And how should they factor in at all to what we're talking about here? This common ownership discussion has remained vigorous since I last had the opportunity to speak about it in June. And I am really heartened to see the serious scholarship continue to examine the theories and empirics at play, and very pleased that the FTC has included this topic in our hearings. Our panelists today will grapple with a number of very intriguing questions, and I'm excited to hear from them all. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Phillips. Our next speaker is my good friend and colleague, Robert Jackson, who was sworn in January as Commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Commission. He comes to the commission from right here at NYU Law, where he's a professor of law on leave. I can't resist noting here the deep connection between the SEC and these FTC hearings. As Bob Potofsky, who I mentioned before, liked to explain, it was a series of FTC hearings like these that led to the creation of the SEC. Previously, Commissioner Jackson served as a senior policy advisor to the Department of the Treasury. Earlier in his career, Commissioner Jackson practiced law at Wachtell Lipton and Katz. Commissioner Jackson.
Well, thank you so much to my friend and colleague, Professor Hemphill, and to all my friends here at NYU and at the Federal Trade Commission for hosting these very important conversations. It's really a privilege to be back here at NYU and speaking before the FTC. And I share the commitment that everybody brings here this morning to make sure our markets are competitive and fair for all Americans. Now, when I give a speech like this, I'm supposed to give a caveat, which is that these are my views, not the views of anybody else at the SEC. But I don't even work at the FTC, so I should give the further caveat of the total irrelevance of my views. However, I want to point out that it's been my experience that just given enough time and wisdom, all my colleagues at the SEC figure out I was right all along. It never happens. So one of the things that's important to begin here is with some history, which, as Professor Hemphill alluded to, back in the 1933 and at the adoption of the 33 and 34 Acts, the 33 Act used to be enforced by this agency. Famously, the Securities Division at the FTC first implemented the securities laws before the creation of my agency in 1934, and that's why the FTC is in a very real way, in an important way, both historically and intellectually, the birthplace of the SEC. So it's good to be home. I remarked in a recent speech about the fundamental analytical mistake we've been making in American securities markets to assume that we at the SEC can regulate our capital markets without thinking through the effects of those choices on competition. I said there, and I believe this morning, that the FTC and SEC should be working more closely together so we can better oversee these markets and the exact kind of issues we're discussing today. In fact, the subject of today's hearing, in my judgment, which is really competition and consumer protection in the 21st century, highlights the compelling need for this close collaboration. And I hope my appearance today marks the beginning of that partnership. Now, the subject of today's hearing, and you'll hear about evidence all morning, is whether institutional investors, and primarily passive index funds, that hold large stakes in American public companies, can decrease competition and raise prices for consumers. It's a critical debate on which I'll explain my view shortly. But I've come here today to urge all of you to think about common ownership and the subject we'll discuss today and identify it for what it is, which is an investor protection problem. a corporate governance problem. In my judgment, we're at a pivotal moment in American financial history when corporate elections are increasingly decided by a handful of exceptionally powerful index fund managers. And what's clear to me is that the SEC's current rules leave investors largely in the dark about how institutional investors are wielding that considerable authority. And I'm here today to call on my colleagues at the SEC to pursue rules that will take advantage of existing data on institutional voting to empower investors with more and better information on how their money is voted in American corporate elections. More on that in a moment, but let me begin with the common ownership debate. First of all, for anybody who believes, as I do, that all good research scholars have an obligation to seek policy impact in their work, today's hearing is an enormous victory. Because we're here, of course, because of exceptionally important and thoughtful scholarship by my friends in the academy who've done work that has taught me a great deal that I didn't know about the relationship between common ownership and competition. Of course, the seminal piece is by Jose Azar, Martin Schmaltz, and Isabel Tiku, an extraordinary recent paper in the Journal of Finance that demonstrates a relationship between measures of common ownership and price increases in the airline industry. And of course, Professor Elhaig has incredibly thoughtfully moved the debate forward, examining the ways in which we should be thinking about those data for the enforcement of the antitrust laws. I commend that work to all of you, and as a researcher, I can only admire the enormous scholarly and policy impact that that research has had. My own reaction to the work is that it presents us with a puzzle, and that we're at the beginning, not the end, of our conversation about common ownership and what to do about it. And let me say why. First of all, my NYU colleagues, Professors Hempel and Kahan, in a recent paper, explain the difficulty with using the measures set forth in that scholarship for evaluating the questions we're discussing today, and in particular the MHHI measure and the MHHI delta measure employed in those papers. And there's two things that I want to highlight in the Hempel-Kahan paper that I commend to all of you that to me sets the agenda for moving forward with scholarly work on common ownership. First, as Professors Hempel and Kahan explain, there are a number of different strategies that that an institutional investor might pursue in connection with the reduction of competition in their portfolio companies. One is to eliminate competition within a particular, or reduce competition within a particular firm in an industry, permitting rent extraction for other firms and the total value of the portfolio to rise. Another is to restrict production across the industry, permitting rent extraction across all firms in the industry. And the crucial thing to see that Professors Hempel and Kahan point out is that these are two very, very different strategies from the point of view of an undiversified investor. That is, one will meet with approval from that undiversified investor, and another will be resisted. To the degree that those two strategies reflect completely different ways of thinking about the impact of common ownership on competition, or I should say, the potential impact, we need new scholarship that studies the difference between those strategies, in particular that looks for cases where an undiversified owner of the firm will resist the purported anti-competitive instincts of the diversified owners. As Professors Hempel and Kahan point out, we don't yet have that paper. We don't yet have scholarship that tackles that, and indeed, as they point out, I think very importantly, the MHHI measure itself is not designed to test that hypothesis. No, instead we need new scholarship with new measures that test that particular difference in those two strategies to see whether or not we actually have hard evidence of this kind of activity in American industry. But much more importantly for my purposes, as Professors Kahan and Hempel point out, and as my colleagues Dan Rubenfeld and Ed Rock have also pointed out in an important paper this year in the Antitrust Journal, Law Journal, there's very little evidence so far about the precise mechanism by which such activity might take place. There's a great deal of speculation about how this might occur. And I find the preliminary evidence on that subject extremely interesting. In particular, Professor Schmaltz, along with a group of co-authors, has a recent paper on the use of relative performance measures, relative performance compensation-based incentives that may or may not contribute to competition in an industry. Now, as someone who has studied executive compensation for many years, I would love to think that it's that important to competition in American industry. Indeed, I'm biased to believe that a change in managers' relative incentives could affect price setting across American industries, because otherwise I've been wasting my life. But I'm unpersuaded by the evidence we have so far, and here's why. Changes in incentives at the top of the house in an American public company can have many, many effects, and I'm inclined to believe it can work throughout the organization to have an effect on price setting, but we don't yet have hard evidence that it does so. And I would want to understand the organizational design and the differences from industry to industry in the price setting authority throughout a firm to better comprehend how changes in relative performance incentives could have an effect on prices. Now, whatever you think of this evidence, as I said earlier, in my view, we are at the beginning, not the end of the debate on concentrated common ownership. And I took with great interest a careful look at the work of Eric Posner, Fiona Scott Morton, and Glenn Weil with respect to potential proposals to limit diversification or to regulate institutional investors in order to address the issues in this literature. And I must tell you, as somebody who's sworn to protect investors, my sense is that the literature we have today does not carry the heavy burden that a commissioner sworn to protect investors should demand in order to impose limitations on diversified investment in American public companies. I say that for many reasons, but most importantly because diversified holdings have delivered an enormously important product to American families who are saving for retirement and education. These are the savings I'm sworn to protect, and to restrict their diversification would impose costs upon them that are potentially enormous. Also, as Professors Rock and Rubenfeld pointed out, we wouldn't have even begun to contemplate the effects of such a rule on other industries that common ownerships might own, concentrated common owners might own. For example, if we think about the airline industry, we'd need to begin to think about limits on diversification in their suppliers, in others who play a role in the distribution or consumption of airline activity. And all of these knock-on effects, to my mind, have not yet been sufficiently considered for me to be supportive of a rule that would restrict diversification in American investment. But my concern about those proposals is not so much that their burden has not been met. I don't think it has. I think we're at the beginning of a conversation that might someday lead to sufficient evidence in that respect. But we're not yet at a place where I would be comfortable with such a resolution. Whatever you think about that, my concern is that it's distracting us from the actual issue we should discuss today. To me, the particular issue that deserves and demands more attention than it's received, both at the FTC and at my agency, is the fact that today institutional investors cast votes in corporate elections on behalf of more than 100 million American families. They wield enormous influence on the future of our companies and our communities. But we're not giving investors nearly enough information about how their money is being voted. And because of that, American investors can't make choices among index funds about the way that they carry out those duties. And it's time for that to change. Now, the shareholder vote, we all understand well, is a critical tool in setting governance policies of companies and holding management accountable for their actions. And that's why another series of recent papers that I believe you'll hear about later today, in my view, deserve as much attention as the common concentrated ownership scholarship you'll also be talking about. In particular, Professor John Coates, my corporate law professor, a fact for which he will never fully be forgiven, has a recent paper identifying what he calls the problem of 12. It's an extraordinary paper in that it makes a very simple point. Actually, it's the rare empirical paper that confesses that it just picked a number out of thin air. Coates' point is not that there's actually 12 people who control corporate America. It's that that number is a realistic, reasonable ballpark of the number of people who make decisions about the future of American corporations. And he worries about the credibility of any securities market, any product market, where that much power is wielded by that few people, and so do I. Professor Coates identifies a number of particular potential resolutions of that problem. I'll discuss them in a moment. But what he knows, because he's been thinking about agency problems for a very long time, is that what's happened here is in a search for holding corporate management accountable, we have transferred the potential for agency problems from corporate management to institutional investors who now wield the extraordinary authority that Coates describes in his paper. Indeed, with all respect to Professor Coates, his insight is not new. My friends at Columbia, Ron Gilson and Jeff Gordon, years ago published a paper, The Agency Cost of Agency Capitalism, that pointed out increasingly the role of institutional investors in deciding about the agenda items that are set by other less diversified, more activist investors. And since the publication of that article in the Columbia Law Review a few years ago, that problem has grown more, not less, relevant to policy debates in corporate law. Now, the question is, what should we do about it? And for me, the clearest path forward is set by another recent paper that I commend for all of you. I'm giving you a lot of homework, I realize. Another recent paper by my friends Ryan Bubb and Emiliano Catan of NYU. This is an extraordinary piece that takes years of data disclosed at form NPX, over more than a decade since that form became effective at the SEC, and shows the party structure of mutual fund voting. What Bubb and Catan demonstrate is that we can use standard models of political decision making to understand the various ways that institutional investors vote. They offer a model that distributes those votes across three different parties of institutional investors: the managerialist party, the shareholder intervention party, and the shareholder veto party. Now, one thing about the Bubb and Catan paper that is so striking is that we didn't know it before. That is, for years, institutional investors have been putting billions of dollars of American family savings to work in pursuit of those choices, and we just now have learned the way that they're making them. And that's why today I'm calling on my colleagues at the SEC to put forth new rules that would require better disclosure of information just like that. Now, you might say to me, oh, Rob, we don't need new rules. It's already in Form NPX. And I would invite you to read one and try to do the difficult work an investor must do in the United States today to try to understand both at the fund level and at the portfolio family level the way that votes are cast. My sense is that Ryan and Emiliano can tell you stories of many late nights spent trying to decipher this form. Whatever you think about that, what I'd say is it's our job at the SEC to make more clear the ways that institutional investors are discharging their obligations to the people that they're voting for. And I'm happy to say it's my impression that most large institutions agree. After all, Larry Fink each year publishes a clear view about what he plans to do in discharging that responsibility. You can go to Vanguard or Fidelity's website, they'll tell you all about what they plan to do. And my call today is for us to put that information in front of American retail investors when they put their money down. In my view, at the moment when a retail investor makes the decision to be in a particular mutual fund family, to use a particular index product, they should have an understanding of how their money will be voted. You might be inclined to say they won't care. First of all, that is, I love to say this since it gives me papers to write, an empirical question. But even if it weren't, I ask all of you to keep in mind the enormously powerful ex ante effects of a disclosure regime of this kind. The notion that someday a retail investor at the point of sale will be given salient, relevant information of the kind in the Bubb Catan paper might get institutional investors thinking a little more about which party they belong to and why. The ex ante benefits of this kind of disclosure were the basis for the 33 and 34X. And the notion that American retail investors won't read all this so it doesn't matter, in my view, is, with all respect, mistaken. What I'm interested in is providing institutional investors with the knowledge before they cast those votes that they're going to have to tell people in salient, clear terms how they are voting Americans' money. For me, that is a path to real accountability for those institutional investors and a beginning of an answer to Professor Coates' challenge about what to do about the concentrated power that institutional investors wield in the United States. Let me conclude by saying how important I think today's conversation is, and I feel very fortunate to be here, because This is exactly the way policy should be made in the United States. We should have researchers, like Professor Schmaltz and Professor Elhague, put on the table important new questions that we haven't thought enough about, offer policy solutions. We should debate whether they're right or wrong for the people of the United States. We should demand better evidence when we need it, and we should be willing to act when we have it. And in my view, what we know now about institutional investors in the United States is that they wield a tremendous amount of influence over the future of the economy in this country. And as a result, we need to do better about the ways in which we hold them accountable for those decisions. So thanks so much to my colleagues at NYU and at the FTC for holding these important hearings, and I look forward to the conversation. Thank you very much.
Chance to finish their colloquy here.
Commissioner Phillips, any reactions to Professor Jackson's remarks that you want to
I think my most important reaction is he should send me the Catan paper, which I haven't yet read.
I think we can arrange that. Professor Catan is here.
Actually, we should just, in the interest of full disclosure, tell them. Noah leaned over and said, I knew you were going to try and grab power from the FTC. He's right.
Things were good in 1933. They ruined everything in 34. No, I thought it was a fascinating speech. I think I was struck that Commissioner Jackson and I, in many respects, with respect to common ownership, see things somewhat similarly. I think we see similar kind of tensions in the literature, similar kinds of questions to ask. Both of us agree that we need to see more research. We're both very grateful for everyone being here and for this debate going on. I absolutely agree that this is a better way to make policy in the United States. At the very end of my remarks, I alluded to the column that followed on the Coates paper by John Bogle. I think those are very interesting questions as well.
Professor Jackson, any reaction to Professor Phillips or to the Wall Street Journal commentary from a few days ago? I'll throw that in too.
I thought Bogle was exactly right. And it's really striking from an historical point of view to see this from the inventor of the index fund. You know, my own view is that the problem that we have, which is that index investing has become so popular as to raise this debate, is what one might think of as a first-class problem. I mean, we have delivered an enormously valuable product to American investors that has paid for untold millions of retirements, educations, incredibly important. This is the way that the American people access the growth in our economy. So it's an enormously important product. It's become so powerful, so popular, so ubiquitous, that we need to talk about the ways in which those who vote that money are abiding that responsibility. That seems to me the right place to be for the conversation. I think we also need to be very wary of the emerging evidence that there might be an anti-competitive effect here. Because to the degree that that case gets fully proved, I think we do need to have a conversation about making sure that American industry is sufficiently competitive. So I continue to watch with interest as that literature evolves. But my own judgment is that we're at the beginning rather than the end of that conversation as a matter of optimal policy.
Well, I think with that, I'm going to thank both of our...
Do you want to take questions from folks?
Sure. I'm happy to take questions from people.
Yes. I guess we'll need a microphone.
Well, if you have questions, you should set them out on question cards and bring them up because we did that quite a bit.
And I can repeat it, depending.
Hi.
The question is simply this. I agree with your tilt about where the focus should be. The question of concentration is clear, and the other is far from clear. But in terms of disclosure, which seems to be where you're heading with respect to institutional ownership, is there any thought about disclosure of conflicts of interest, compensation, time horizons,
Seems more your lane than mine.
This was a question posed to Commissioner Jackson.
Yes.
So it's a good question. So let me say a few things about this. First of all, because I was diving into the Bob Catan paper, I spent some time in Form NPX. First of all, just as a matter of like human advice, don't. Like, don't do that with your time. But what I found is that it already contains some of the information. Like, this is why I think the policy shift here is one that makes sense. It's a very rich set of detail. You can get a lot out of it. It's just incomprehensible. And so a lot of the things you're talking about, for example, incentive structure, portfolio family structure, the way people are voting across the organization, if you work hard enough, it's there. So my answer to your question is yes, I think those things can and should be more summarily disclosed. And my case for this, for moving forward with such a rule, is that the information is already being produced in the largest institutional investors. My guess would be that the marginal cost of producing it in a summary, more digestible fashion in the way that the Bob Catan paper presents it would not be costly. Now, we can have a debate over the benefits of that, whether or not it would move the needle. I'm happy to have that conversation, but my answer to your question is yes, and moreover, I don't think it would be marginally as costly as everyone might imagine to make that information more accessible to American investors.
Can I just add one thing to that? To me, and I haven't read the Bob Catan paper, I haven't looked at any one of these forms in my life.
How dare you?
I have read 10-Ks and 10-Qs. This is a species of a long-standing, ongoing discussion about how the provision of information, the mandatory provision of information, the amount of information, the medium of its communication, and critically for purposes of Commissioner Jackson's remarks, the timing of the disclosure information empower shareholders, but also consumers to make decisions in the market. Where you have information out there, there are times where it can very easily be reflected in, let's say, a liquid capital market. This is something we are grappling with now with Congress in the context of privacy. Right? Everyone here is familiar with the fact that you get little pop-up notices that tell you how the website you're visiting is going to use your information. Raise your hand if you've read one. Okay, and this is a very well-educated group of people. So we all believe in markets, and we all believe in the capacity of markets to help allocate resources efficiently. Markets require information, and so some of the most vexing questions that we face is how best to feed that information into those markets. It's a question of how shares are voted in elections. It's a question of the financials of companies, right? That's the 33 Act and the 34 Act, mostly 33 Act. It's a question in privacy. It's a broader issue. And you know, it's good to look at these questions and keep up to date on how consumers, whether they be consumers of investments or consumers elsewhere in the market, assimilate information.
So one question from the audience. Could each of y'all say a little bit more? This is about a question about passive versus active. Could y'all say a little more about the kind of fundamental differences between passive investors and active investors for both of these sets of issues that are on the table? Maybe we'll start with you, Professor Phillips.
Sure, since that was my nomenclature, so I guess I'm responsible for it.
It shows up in the literature, too, to some degree.
So to me, the critical distinction, has to do with if you believe that common ownership may present a competition problem, or even if you simply believe that it's a problem for purposes of competition that all sorts of folks, whether they be common owners or otherwise, don't have adequate incentive to spur firm management to compete. To me, you need to think about what are the mechanisms for spurring that competition? Who are the right people to do it? I think, as I mentioned, we need to look at the various ways in which we approach, I'm gonna stick in competition policy lane, the ways we approach competition policy and always be thinking about, will this chill that kind of input from shareholders? Or will it help Shareholders encourage firms to compete. That is a really important dynamic in the market. It's important for purposes of large asset managers. It's important for purposes of smaller activist investors. It's important across the board. So I think, to me, the remedy question is really, really important. And also, as I said before, to me, there is a big distinction. If you subscribe to the active theory, you support one kind of remedy. If you subscribe to the passive theory, the stay passive doesn't really look very attractive as a remedy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Rob? So I'll take the question in a slightly different direction and talk about this, the distinction more broadly in the capital markets between what we're calling activist and passive investors, as opposed to a particular theory about the behavior of concentrated common owners. You know, for me, it's been fascinating to watch over the last decade the increasingly blurred lines between what someone calls an active and passive investor. And I'm quite sure that of all the people who could decide what the difference is, I'm least qualified to dictate to the marketplace what it means to be truly active. Let me say why. You hear a lot about activist investors and the things we might do or not do. You know, I'm not sure who people mean when they focus on activists in particular, but if what they mean is people who are thoughtfully engaged in the governance of public companies, you could very well include index fund managers who are voting their shares. And indeed, I think the point that the Gordon and Gilson paper made years ago is that there's this important interaction we don't fully understand between these two types of investors. Activists play an important role in agenda setting in a way that passive investors might not. But the crucial decision about who wins is often left to those institutional investors because they carry such sway with respect to votes at large public companies. In fact, if you talk to any activist, they'll tell you, and the data are beginning to make this clear, that what dictates the success of their strategy, and I suspect increasingly the targets that they choose, is the degree to which they feel they can persuade those institutions, those passive institutions, that they are right. And so for me, the interaction between these two types of investors is one that hasn't been studied as thoroughly as it could, especially empirically. I think the Gordon Gilson paper gives us a good set of testable propositions. I think it's time to test them, because my own sense is that we call one group activist, we call another group passive, and I understand fundamentally the difference is that for a passive investor, the sort of the components of the index are dictated to them by the index provider, but I think it's a distinction increasingly without a difference when we think about who's really wielding power in American corporate elections.
Mm-hmm. Can I take a step back just for a minute? Both of y'all in your remarks have, you know, kind of identified an ambitious agenda, partly an ambitious agenda for research, for further work, especially by empiricists to try to make sense of some of these issues. Is there anything that you all see the agencies doing to play a role? I mean, both the SEC and the FTC have, you know, both, you know, fact-finding capabilities and also, you know, strong internal research teams. I just wondered if either of y'all could reflect a little bit on whether it's more data, whether it's more analytical work, internal to you all. I mean, setting the agenda for the rest of us is awesome. I'm just wondering, you know, what about y'all?
Is there sufficient too?
Yeah, right. Sufficient too. Right, right. Is there, you know, how much of a role is there to play? What might that look like?
I mean,
do you have thoughts about that?
Well, I'm going to take this as the softball that you didn't intend. To me, this is the start of it, right? So today we're going to sit here and we're going to listen to the best minds in America on a variety of different but interrelated topics, talk about the state of the art in research, what are the questions that are unanswered, where is their agreement. You know, Commissioner Jackson's call for sort of other metrics would be a great example of that. This is a good way of highlighting those areas and aiming those resources. You know, there are certain authorities at our disposal. I will tell you, there are many people who think we should use authorities to study a great many of topics, and you know, we have to be somewhat measured. But I think this, convening folks, bringing it to the public, inviting in the conversation, and inviting criticism back and forth, which I hope is what we see today, is precisely the way to start.
I think we will see some of that today.
Oh yeah, man, you're gonna get that for sure. So here's what I would say. I think one thing that I have suggested in past remarks, and you know, the chairman at the SEC and I have talked about it, and I hope we'll continue the conversation about it, is joint research work between our two agencies. Not only because of the historical mandate that we share, but because fundamentally these questions can't be tackled with the data that one or both. And increasingly, frankly, when I talk to the research economists at the FTC and in our house, they have sort of very different data and perspectives on these questions. And so I would like very much for us to be considering joint work in the area. I think putting together a task force of researchers on both agencies is something worth considering, because you're not wrong, Scott, that, you know, we gave you guys a lot of homework today. By the way, I should confess my conflict. I might be one day a guy who'll do that homework, so it's like, yeah, I'm providing supply for my own, it's complicated. Anyway, I guess my view is that you're right to push us and say, there's gotta be something that the agencies can do in terms of setting out an agenda, roundtables, et cetera, where we can do some in-house work ourselves. And I think that's something we ought to give a lot of thought to.
So a question from the audience. It's a question about how to get a more active, aggressive corporate governance, I think. So are there regulatory, or what are the kind of most important regulatory or legal barriers? This, I mean, I think the premise of the question is that a more active corporate governance would be attractive. What are the regulatory or legal barriers to that?
Well, you know, I talked a little bit in my speech about an issue at which I'm beginning to look, which is the impact of Hart-Scott-Rodino. Hart-Scott-Rodino is a mechanism to deal with antitrust issues. It doesn't go beyond that. I think we need to look at mechanisms that exist in the market that are either intended to or have the effect of chilling shareholder input. I think that's a really important principle of which we can't lose sight. That, as I've said in the past and I sort of reiterate today, this to me has to be part of the weighing of the common ownership issue, which is, I mean, antitrust liability is a very powerful thing. You know, it's in civil lawsuits, treble damages. The remedies from antitrust actions can be severe, and some of the remedies that are proposed for common ownership by some of the proponents of the theory are admittedly would have a drastic impact. And I think once you, you know, if you're talking about antitrust, you're going to chill the conduct that you're looking at. And that needs to be part of that weighing that I mentioned. That's why I called for a rigorous weighing. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so ways to have more active corporate governance. How much time do you have? Yeah, I have ideas about that. So a few things. So first of all, it's important to begin by understanding the fundamental economics that an institutional investor faces when they think about engaging. And Lucian Bebchuk and Scott Hurst have a terrific pair of papers where they walk through the incentives that institutional investors have or don't have. And the short version that we've understood for some time now is that making those investments in engagement is expensive. It's very hard to cover the scope of companies that they must when they have the kind of portfolio that they do. They're making those investments. You can see that in the corporate governance teams at the very large institutions. I've spent time with those teams. They're doing good work, but it's an enormous task that they face. And for me, my goal as a regulator is always to reduce the marginal cost of them doing that work. So I want to make sure that we give them the disclosure that they need to get the information that they want to cast those votes. That's why, for example, I pushed so hard to finish the disclosure rules on executive compensation and corporate governance under Dodd-Frank. That statute's 8 years old. We haven't finalized the majority of those rules. That's information that institutional investors have to go out on their own to get. It costs them money on the margin to do that. It makes them less likely to be actively engaged in corporate governance. It's just like it's just a fact. Also, I think we should be looking at other ways to reward institutional investors and make it possible for them to access channels of engaging with the company. So, just to give an example. There's increasingly proxy access proposals that have been adopted at public companies that provide some realistic path for institutional investors to actually have a contested election at a public company. I really feel like the case for the universal proxy proposal that was put forth at the SEC before the new administration took place is very powerful. And like Commissioner Phillips, these things are all related. Because he's right, to the degree you say that we're worried about antitrust, not only do the basic economics of institutional investing make it difficult for these folks to engage on the margin, but it raises the specter of too much engagement producing liability under the antitrust laws, which I worry deters very beneficial oversight of corporate management.
So does the homework that y'all have given us potentially do that a little bit, right? I mean, should we be worried about institutional investors turning tail because, look, you know, we're talking through the possibility that we've had this walking antitrust violation for some time, the cure to which is to do less governance?
Oh, for sure. That's...
I mean, how strongly should we take that?
I think that's a very real cost. I think those who have advanced those proposals have acknowledged that cost, that there is some downside to raising the specter of antitrust liability because to the degree you get too much engagement from an institutional investor, it provides evidence of that kind of influence that might raise questions from an antitrust point of view. And as a scholar of corporate governance, I worry about that. Here's what I want to say. I don't want to go too far down the road of a false choice because we can empower institutional investors to engage and act and still be mindful of and pay close attention to the degrees to which they use those channels or don't use those channels to reduce competition. I don't think we have to choose between effective corporate governance and reduced competition in the United States. But I do worry, and here's my real frustration. There are ready tools at our disposal, provide better disclosure on executive pay, finish the rules that we've got, do universal proxy. There are ready tools that would allow us to do that, and I think it's time for us at the SEC to start taking that seriously.
So another question from the audience. I might need a little bit of help just clarifying it. So I think the question is essentially about who are these people that are voting the shares? Just trying to get educated on how many people are actually voting these institutional investors' shares, who are they within the organization? I think just try to get a little bit more educated about that.
So not to step on what Commissioner Jackson was saying, I think part of what he was pointing out is this is an area where we are beginning to learn a little bit more. We're beginning to learn about the dynamic. I expect that we are going to hear today some description of like at-large institutional asset managers, how stewardship works, mm-hmm. like what that process actually is.
Yeah, I think that's right. And actually, just to point out a really interesting and important dynamic, even in the empirical literature, I mentioned the Bob Catan paper, there's a debate about the right unit of measurement for casting votes. Should it occur at the fund family, at the portfolio level, the fund family level? There's another paper that takes a different approach for all kinds of interesting reasons. Just to give you a sense, these are brand new, cutting edge, emerging papers that are debating at what level are these votes cast. So that's why I say we're sort of at the beginning of the conversation. Mm-hmm. Also, by the way, Scott, I would predict heterogeneity among institutions mm-hmm. with respect to the kind of group that they put together. Who actually wields power in that group? Is it the portfolio manager? Is it someone just above them in the organizational hierarchy? Is it, I think my understanding when I talk to people is that there's heterogeneity even with respect to that authority. Mm-hmm. And that's something that the literature is just now beginning to understand. Mm-hmm.
And to me, just to add one thing, this was alluded to earlier, there are also players outside of the institutional asset managers themselves, right? There are other investors who may communicate with them. There are proxy advisors. There is a broader universe of folks involved in that kind of decision making.
Man, I just want to point out, we got down to 6 minutes left and almost made it without mentioning ISS. I was like, I'm still waiting for the day where I do something on that. That's right. There are other players in this ecosystem. It's worth thinking and talking about them. We're having it actually at the SEC, to the chairman's great credit, we had a really interesting roundtable discussion of those issues a couple of weeks ago, and I think I really think my colleagues on the commission are thinking hard about these questions, which is why it's such a good moment for a conversation like today's.
So one other question from the audience, I think, is picking up the theme of heterogeneity that you guys were just talking about and wanting to focus attention for a minute on index fund managers, right? A diversified portfolio across not just within an industry, public companies in an industry, but across industries, in some sense, approximating the whole economy. So the question is whether we should really worry about index funds to the extent that they own not just the competitors, but also the suppliers and also
to some degree, depending the the customers. How does that change how we think? If it does, how does it change how we think about that kind of institutional investor?
Well, to me, especially for purposes of the antitrust discussion, this is part of the nuance into which we have to get. I think, take a hostile merger, right? If you worry about, too much power invested in an institution generally for purposes along the line of Coates and Bogle's argument, if you worry about antitrust liability, part of what you may have in mind is the notion that the asset manager just thinks generally or about itself broadly. Take a contest where the shares are held in companies that don't have a shared interest. How are they being voted? Right? Are they being voted the same way? Because if they're being, if they're voting against themselves, they may not be operating in the way that we might think of someone who just owns a lot of shares voting unilaterally. I think those dynamics and those nuances are critical to understand. The leveling of the sort of supply chain that you not only have an interest in one company, but in the companies from which that company buys and the companies to which that company sells, that is another level of nuance in terms of understanding what the sort of broad asset manager interest might be.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, this is why the Azar and the LA papers are so interesting and important because, when I begin to try to think through, if you're an institutional investor and you want to reduce competition, how do you think about that across your entire portfolio, not just in the industry? How do you think about suppliers, customers, et cetera? It's an enormously complicated calculus. It's not, one of the things that the literature has done for me is clarify what the objective function might be in that situation, what they might be trying to do. So what we could meaningfully put on the left-hand side in terms of what the institutions might be trying to achieve. Look, I think he's right that it's a good thing to start with understanding the various calculus that one might do if they exercise that influence. And then I think, as your paper points out, what we really want is to make sure we have a measure that tests that strategy. And I think that's where the literature, I hope, is going. And the more recent paper on relative performance incentives, I think, takes a big step in that direction. Really has given me a lot of food for thought about, okay, now that helps me understand what the thesis might be, right? Because these guys are paid for exceptional within industry performance. So maybe that's a mechanism we can think through. So understanding the basic economics of what a concentrated common owner strategy might be is I think, where we need to go in terms of understanding this literature better.
Any closing thoughts? Can I give a minute to each of y'all if there's anything you want to close with?
I just want to close with my real enthusiasm. I have booked my train late enough to stay for as much of today as I can. I think this is going to be one of the most interesting debates. I think we are literally and physically at the intersection of two very interesting areas of law, both of which focus on markets and their optimal functioning. So I just want to thank, really, everyone for being here with us.
Yeah, I certainly agree. I think this is the case for research. This is why research is so important to me. We're here because Martin and Einar and others sort of put this issue front and center for us and are making us think hard about it. Someone who was a researcher, now a policymaker, it's rewarding for me to see the payoff of that research. And when I say we're at the beginning of the conversation, I mean, I'm not only trying to give you guys more papers to write, I'm also learning in a very real way about the ways that I should think about doing my job well. So I'm very grateful to all of you for that, and I very much look forward to the conversation.
Great. With that, please join me in thanking Commissioner Phillips and Commissioner Jackson.